Hello, this is Chris English with At Home This Morning, a magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a window to our world, both in and around our city of Brighton and Hove and further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old, and of course some music that I hope you'll enjoy. In this programme, we'll be hearing from John Paul Amos about just how Neighbourhood Watch has been so successful in Woodingdean under his guidance. Chris Seymour will be bringing us news of Rottingdean Fair by talking to Graham Shepherd, and I'll be having a chat with Volks Electric Railway Association Chairman Ian Gledhill, all about the forthcoming celebrations to mark the railway's 135 years of operation. Jill Peters and Maria Barney will be here to tell us all about the Hanover Beer Festival, and in particular, how you can sponsor your own barrel. But first, regular listeners may recall that in my last programme, I mentioned that I was off to Chichester Festival Theatre to see their latest production, Me and My Girl, on opening night, though less. And so it was that my wife and I took our seats a few days ago, full of anticipation. Until, that is, the show's director, Daniel Evans, appeared on stage to inform the sold-out audience that star-turned Matt Lucas had developed a throat infection, and his role, the key character of Bill Snibson, would be played instead by Ryan Pidgeon, who had just 4 hours to prepare, an announcement that, not unsurprisingly, brought forth loud groans from the assembled throng. And so we all just sat back and expected to have to suffer a less than perfect performance. But that is not what we got, as Ryan and the rest of the cast gave us their all in every respect, from the first note until the 5-minute-long standing ovation that had everybody on their feet, me included, in appreciation of a truly wonderful piece of classic musical theatre, provided by a cast who truly gave their all. Now, in case you're not familiar with the story, which was originally written by L. Arthur Rose and Douglas Ferber in the 1930s, and updated for an earlier London production by none other than Stephen Fry and Mike Ockrent, the basic concept is that a Cockney barrow boy, Bill Snibson, is in fact a long-lost heir to a title that brings with it money and a totally different lifestyle. A lifestyle that threatens Bill's relationship with his girlfriend Sally, all of which may sound a bit of a drag, but is in fact 1,000 miles away from any such thing. As usual, the set at Chichester is a simple but highly effective masterpiece, complete with seemingly improbable changes carried out by the cast with complete aplomb, and a large but unseen orchestra that produces just the right sound, not too loud, all conducted by musical director Daniel Evans, who is located in a rather odd triangular-shaped hole towards the front of the stage, and around which the cast perform, hopefully without ever actually falling in. Now, apart, of course, from Ryan, there are equally epic and largely unexpected performances from the cast. For example, TV star Caroline Quentin breaking into a hilarious tap dance. There's Jenny Dale as a straight-laced legal beagle with a great and equally unexpected singing voice, altogether with a wicked sense of comic timing. Then there is Jack Skelly, who is great as Charles the Butler, and Sebon Harrison, who turns her character Lady Jacqueline Carston into a really, truly breathtaking vamp, complete with bubbles in a bath. And of course, I mustn't forget to mention Clive Rowe, who plays Sir John Tremayne with huge force and charm. And while I could go on to mention every single member of a truly great cast, instead I would just implore you to go along to see Me and My Girl at the Chichester Festival Theatre. It runs until the 25th of August, and I promise you that it's well worth a trip. Now it's that time of year when cities, towns and villages all over the country hold their summer events. And here in Rottingdean, it's no exception. And this year, the summer fete is on Saturday the 4th of August. To find out more, Chris Seymour has been talking to organiser Graham Shepherd.
So, Graham, it's rather special this year, two events being commemorated.
Yes, we often have a theme for the village fair, and this year the theme is Remembering 1918, and obviously to remember the anniversary of the ending of the First World War and also the suffragette movement. So it's combining those two things, really, and there was a lot of links between Rottingdean and the suffragettes and obviously the war. And also, actually, the British Legion are going to rededicate the war memorial. They're going to do a short service at 1 o'clock. They're going to have a Union Jack over the memorial, unveil it and have a special ceremony. So it should all be rather poignant and wonderful, really.
For anybody who doesn't really know Rottingdean very well, the war memorial is right in the middle of the village green by the pond.
Yes, I should have said that. Yeah, the war memorial is a really, obviously, in a very sort of special place, right in the middle of the green, next to the pond and adjoining Kipling Gardens. And that's where the fair is. It takes place all over the green and goes right through into Kipling Gardens. So it's a very, very beautiful spot, and we're very, very fortunate to have it in Rottingdean. So, and it's a great place to come along to. And the actual fair itself is a real sort of family affair with all sort of age groups coming along. We have lots of stalls raising money for community, charity, commercial, and a lot of entertainment. And this year we've got the Maypole dancing again, which we reinstigated after a couple of years. It's been going on. It started in about the 1920s. The Salvation Army will be there. There'll be singers, dancers and various other things going on. It should be a really wonderful day, weather permitting. We always pray for the weather, for good weather. Yes.
I know you've been rehearsing the Maypole dancing. How many groups do you think you're going to be having there?
Well, we only have one group, and we ask for volunteers from children, from the Cubs, the Scouts and schools, and we have two or three practices and make it very informal, enjoyable. And it's often quite nice when mistakes are made and it sort of gets tied up a bit as well, really. But it's a really lovely thing to watch, and people are very welcome to join in. It's a sort of very, very special thing and very particular to Rottingdean.
Let's talk a bit more about the stalls and the events going on. Can you tell us a bit more in detail?
The actual fair starts at 10:30, and then there'll be Maypole dancing, as I say, to start with. There'll be Salvation Army, singing groups and lots of other sort of dancing and various things. And then the stalls, as I say, it's a mixture of community stalls, commercial stalls. And the idea is really that community and charity stalls, they don't pay anything to be at the fair, but all their takings then go for their particular charity or community event. And then the commercial stalls pay a small amount to have their stall there. And then that money goes into a central charity. And this year it's going to a charity called Mascot, which is particular for parents and carers of autistic children, and it's based in Portslade. And we're also raising money for the Trevor Mann Baby Unit, and so those two particular charities. So it's those two charities would benefit, plus all the other charities that have stalls on the village green. And last year we raised about £12,000 for all the various charities. But the main thing is for people to come along and have a really happy family day and enjoy themselves, and what we raise is sort of by the by, really.
Is there an entrance fee?
There's an entrance fee of 50p, and that then goes to sort of help run the fair and also towards the two charities. But for children under 11 years of old, it's free, and there's a little programme. And actually also there's a free lucky draw with different prizes ranging from tea at the Grand Hotel to a yard of Harvey's Ale and that sort of thing. So that should be good, yeah.
Well, it must take a lot of work getting this organised. Do you have enough people to help?
Well, no, we've got a very, very small committee, and I really appreciate all the help they give, and then various community groups around the village. But we're always looking for people to help, particularly to help set up on the Friday evening. So on Friday the 3rd, we'll be there from about 5 o'clock. So if anybody feels strong and wants to come along and join in, then please do. And also clearing up afterwards. So we finish about 4 o'clock, just to help to pick up the litter and tidy things away. It'd be really much appreciated, yes.
Is there an email address people can contact you on?
Yes, yeah, there is. It's rottingdeanvillagefair@gmail.com. And if you could just send any thoughts or ideas, or if you want to come along and help, it'd be much, much appreciated, really, yes.
How long have you been doing this now, Graham?
Well, actually, I think I've been doing the fair for about 5 years. And it came about, and it's quite poignant this year really, because a lady phoned me up called Marjorie Hampton. And Marjorie died this year, and she's been in the village for many, many years. And her husband Peter did lots of work for Christian Aid and all aspects of the village. And she did run the village fair for many years. And she phoned me up about 5 years ago, and she said, "Graham, it's time I moved on, and so it's your turn, Graham." So I had no choice at all. She was that sort of lady. She was a wonderful lady, but a very forceful, determined. She said, "Graham, you're taking over." So I did. And sadly, Marjorie died this year, and our thoughts are with her. And in fact, we've renamed, there's a cup that goes for the best stall, and we've renamed it the Marjorie Hampton Cup in memory of Marjorie. So it's very, very poignant, yeah.
What's your favourite part of the fair?
My favourite part of the fair? I think it's just, I know what it is, standing back and just watching people milling around, sitting, having a pint of beer or a Coke or a hamburger, or watching the entertainment or with their families, and milling around and being relaxed and talking to each other and enjoying themselves. And I do particularly love the Salvation Army when they play. It sort of, it gives you a real sort of thing of being the English, quintessentially English sort of village fair, really. But it's just seeing people enjoying themselves, really. Yeah.
Now it's time to welcome the chairman of the Woodingdean Neighbourhood Watch, John Paul Amos, to our studio. So firstly, John Paul, what exactly is Neighbourhood Watch?
Well, Neighbourhood Watch is something that's sort of evolved in time, really. It's pretty much what it sounds like, which is neighbours looking out for each other amongst their communities, trying to identify people that might be elderly and vulnerable and maybe be concerned or worried about things that are happening to them, and trying to give them accurate information of the real things that are actually going on and things that they should be aware of, making them feel a lot more secure and also at ease with what's going on around them.
We're talking specifically about Woodingdean. Mm-hmm. Is there a general problem, or is there a general neighbourhood watch scheme?
Well, not a problem, I would say. If anything, it's a benefit, because if you look at how Brighton Hove is divided up into different areas, I believe off the top of my head there's around about 49 different areas in Brighton Hove, and we are in the top five, as in lowest crime in our area. So we do believe that the things that we are doing help that. More than likely, they probably deter people from actually committing more crime in our area, because they know that we've got a very well-organised scheme in progress.
Now, we're talking specifically about Woodingdean Neighbourhood Watch.
Yes.
Some people might say Woodingdean's a bit of a hot spot for crime. Is that fair?
No, it's completely the opposite, actually. We do have crime, and we do have all sorts of crime in Woodingdean. So it could be antisocial behaviour, or you could have violent crime, you could have vehicle crime. But when you actually look at the grand scheme of things, our share of crime is very, very low.
Is it expensive for people to join Neighbourhood Watch?
No, it's absolutely free of charge for anyone to join Neighbourhood Watch. We ask for £1 contribution, because we try and raise money for our scheme. It's quite a large scheme that we're operating. There's nearly 600 signed up members, and then there's over 2,500 people using social media as well. And we do raise money, but Neighbourhood Watch is completely free of charge to join.
Is it a bit of an excuse for the police not being able to do their job because of numbers?
Well, you could blame the police for loads of things, but the reality is that the police haven't got the resources behind them that they used to have, and money is tight in virtually every different sector, and we are supportive of that with the police, because we do understand that they're under tremendous pressure to do their job with the resource that they've got. And what we are doing is trying to be more and more aware of that, and working alongside the police, but also helping to look after ourselves and each other as well.
How important is neighbourliness in this day and age?
Well, I think it makes a community feel stronger if you have got a group of people which are communicating as neighbours and looking out for each other. I do think it is an important role to actually have communication with your neighbours and understand the different types of people that are living near you. And it's nice to actually feel that sometimes you can do some good by helping each other out.
Thinking about domestic situations, how important are things like proper locks, CCTV?
Well, everything's important because no matter how good neighbourhood watch is or policing is, the unfortunate reality is that there will be problems that you can have. I mean, there could be burglary, you could have cold calling, lots of different things that could happen. But locks is important for many reasons, not just to keep yourself secure, but also your insurance won't pay out if you haven't actually taken adequate precautions to protect your property. So it's important that all of your security does comply with what your insurance company are asking for. With things like CCTV and alarm systems, they've definitely got their usage, whether it be a deterrent or whether it's a means to actually catch what's actually happened and be able to give it as usable evidence to the police, which is where CCTV comes in. It's a very useful tool.
Some people might say, isn't this sort of people being NIMBY, like my backyard, sort of interfering with everybody else? Hmm. What's your view on that?
It's very easily to be perceived that way, to be quite honest, but it's not really what we're about or what we're trying to do. What we're more related is, for example, if I just give some examples of some of the things that come up and that we might report to the membership, is recently we've had vehicles going around Wundeen taking things out of people's gardens. And by simply being able to communicate very quickly and accurately of what's going on, people are aware that this is happening and they give them a chance to get some bikes in that they might have left out or close the windows or just be aware that, hang on, that's just happening in the road around the corner from me. And in many ways it helps. It's a prevention rather than an aftersight of what to do after something's happened.
Talking about prevention and what you were saying earlier about locks and windows, I mean, the recent hot weather, you've opened every window in the house to mm-hmm. try and get some.
Yep.
And it's very easy to forget, perhaps when you go to bed. Mm. Should you actually sort of put up with the heat and shut the windows?
No, really, no. You should try and make the house, no matter whether it's winter or summer, you need to be at the most comfortable temperature that suits you. There's no point in staying in a shut-up house boiling and feeling very, very uncomfortable in temperature. You do need ventilation, you do need to keep yourself cool, and equally you need to keep yourself warm in the winter, but you just need to be mindful of when you leave the property that it's, although it takes you a few minutes longer, you do need to secure it before leaving.
Does Neighbourhood Watch provide advice as far as an elderly person living somewhere in Wundeen?
Yeah, there's plenty of advice. I mean, there's lots of different ways that we can have things happening to us which we're uncomfortable with now. There's a book that you can get which is called The Little Book of Scams, that tells you about all the sort of crimes that can be committed over telephones or through the post or by door knockers. And then there's also other things that can need protecting or to be mindful of, about number plates being stolen from vehicles and why that happens, how sometimes you are actually forced into doing things that you don't actually realise are happening, which can be done very, very well nowadays with phone calls which can cast some sort of deception, people pretending they're from a bank or from a trusted organisation and are very, very convincing at what they do. The reason why there's so many scams around is the reality is a lot of people fall for them, and the people that are scamming make money. Yeah, they wouldn't do it otherwise.
And that booklet is called?
The Little Book of Scams.
And where can you get it?
Well, you can get it from your local police. You can also read it online if you want to. It's available online. I know that everyone can't get online. Or you can contact someone via Neighbourhood Watch who should better pass one on to you. They're quite widely available.
Finally, should we be worried about the current situation? As we get older, we get more concerned about things, young people shouting and carrying on. I'm sure it was the same when we were younger, But is it something that we should worry about, or is it just natural evolution?
I think the world's getting a noisier place anyway. If you just remember what it was like parking outside your house 10 years ago compared to what it's like parking outside your house now, it's a changing environment. But I don't think you should, if you hear noise of, I don't think you need to start going into panic mode. But if there is things which are concerning you, which are, let's say, not absolutely immediately serious right now, it's probably best to contact the police 101 service and report it as an incident. And if it is something that's much more serious, it's still 999. That's the tools that we need. But if you're just hearing a bit more noise than usual, a lot of that is just modern society now. I'm not saying it's always pleasant, but it's just the reality of the world. The world is changing.
John Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Now, as we heard in a recent programme, Vaux Railway is back in operation after an extensive refit funded partially by a huge grant from the Heritage Lottery Fund. And to find out how things have settled down, I spoke to the chairman of the Railway Supporters Group. It's known as VERA, Vaux Electric Railway Association. He's Ian Gledhill, who first explains what the association's role was.
We are primarily here to support the council in its operation of the railway, but not just that. We do support it. We provide volunteer labour to support the railway, the council's operations. We raise funds for the railway, particularly through our late evening operations. But we also are here to persuade the council sometimes on certain courses of actions or things that we think should be done or perhaps should not be done. We are here to make the railway more visible to the public. We provide publicity material, we give talks about the railway, we make sure that the public are always aware of it. So we try to keep it in the public eye as well as everything else.
Now, the railway's just gone through this multi-million pound refurbishment. What was VERA's involvement in that?
VERA provided community support because of the money came from the Heritage Lottery Fund. Because the railway is publicly owned, it's owned and operated by the council, lottery funding is only available in those circumstances if they have what they call community support. And VERA is that support. We have supported the railway now for 23 years. We were founded in 1995. And so we provide volunteer labour, as I've just mentioned. We provide publicity. We put an awful lot of effort and money into the railway. So we are the railway's community support. So without our involvement, the lottery funding would not have happened.
Is the railway and the future secure now?
I think it's very much so. I think it's in a better state than it has been now for nearly 30 years. I've been involved with the railway for over 30 years. We have brand new workshops. We're sitting here in one of the restored cars, which is now in a better state than it's been for a long time. I think the long-term future of the railway looks better now than it has for many decades.
There was suggestion that the council once were going to move it to Preston Park and even do away with it altogether. Do you think that will ever happen?
I think not now. The railway, I say, it was at one time a drain on council funds. It's gone through periods where it's made money for the council. Going back to the early 50s when the council were first, the council took it over in 1940. Before that, it was owned privately by the Vaux family. When it reopened after the war, it was carrying 1 million passengers a year. So it made lots of money for the council. Nowadays, it doesn't. But yes, I think the railway's future is assured now. The notion that it should be closed or moved away, yes, there was a motion back in the 60s to move it to East Brighton Park. I think that is now definitely gone. The railway is here to stay. It is the oldest electric railway in the world, and it's that because it still runs on its original route with its original rolling stock. If you moved it, it would cease to be the original railway. So I think the council and everybody in Brighton wants it to stay.
Looking to the history of the railway, I mean, you say it started this long time ago, so when did it actually start?
The railway opened for the first time in 1883. It was almost an experiment on the part of Magnus Volk when he built it. He'd seen a demonstration line in the grounds of the Crystal Palace in 1881, which was built by Werner von Siemens, only a temporary line, and he decided that electric traction was the future. And so he built this almost an experiment to see if it would work. And his initial line was only 300 yards long. It started at the aquarium and ran to the chain pier, 2-foot gauge track. Once he realised it worked, then the following winter he expanded and extended the railway, and that's when it became permanent.
And of course, Magnus's railway is known throughout the world, isn't it? But it's not his only invention, is it?
Magnus was the most amazing person. He was a pioneer of everything electrical. He became keen on electricity when he was just a teenager. By the time he was 18, he was manufacturing little gadgets that were battery operated. And this is in the 1860s, when most people didn't understand electricity at all. He had a little thing called a parlor telegraph set, where you could send a signal from one room to the next by pressing a button and a little arm would waggle. He invented a shocking coil to give people electric shocks, which was then a new experience. Whether they enjoyed it or not is another matter. He had the first telephone in Brighton. He had the first electric light in Sussex. He invented the first electric fire alarm. He installed the time ball on the clock tower. So the railway was just one of many things, but it's the most enduring.
And, of course, the one that sadly is lost is the thing that's known as Daddy Longlegs, but that's not its real title, is it?
It was. Its official title was the Brighton and Rottingdean Seashore Electric Tram Road. And it ran from the Banjo Groin, which is just next to where we're sitting now, to Rottingdean, 3 miles long, and it ran in the sea. Now, how crazy is the idea of running an electric railway in the sea? And so to keep the carriage clear of the water, it was on legs 24 feet high, with wheels at the bottom running on rails, and this carriage that moved above the water, which is where it got its nickname, Daddy Longlegs, because they were.
I mean, it's an amazing concept, and it didn't survive. Why didn't it survive?
It didn't survive primarily because the track got in the way of sea defences. See, you know, we have longshore drift, which is as the tide comes in, because of the rotation of the earth, the tide comes in up the English Channel from west to east, and it pushes the beach. So our beach is constantly moving all the way from Cornwall through to Kent. Beaches are moving from west to east, and it scours the beach sometimes in certain places. And to prevent that, the council built breakwaters in the 1860s and 1870s to preserve the beach. But they found by the 1890s that it was getting worse. And that's just at the time that Magnus had built this railway, which ran about 200 yards from the shoreline. And when they wanted to extend the breakwaters to preserve the beach, the track was in the way. So in January of 1901, the track was cut to allow the beach defences to be extended, and it never ran again.
But there was a storm involved as well.
The storm was a little earlier than that. The storm was just 6 days after it opened. It opened on the 28th of November 1896, and just 6 days later there was the storm that destroyed the chain pier, and it also destroyed the Daddy Longlegs. Now, 6 days. I think most people would have given up after that, but Magnus Volk wasn't that kind of man. So as soon as the storm was over, he looked at it and he said, well, we've got the wheels and the motor and bits of the carriage. There's enough there, we can rebuild it. And he persuaded his fellow directors to rebuild the line, and it reopened 7 months later.
I mean, it's amazing to think of that in this day and age. I mean, it would take 7 years to get it running.
Well, nowadays you'd have health and safety to cope with. There was no health and safety regulation. There were regulations, of course, and the railway, the Daddy Longlegs came under the railway inspectorates, just like railways do now. But the idea of mixing electricity with salt water, I don't think you'd get that passed today. But yes, you're quite right. Things could be done in those days much quicker than they are now. I'm thinking now, here's a totally different example, but the Crystal Palace. The largest iron and glass building in the world ever built was built in 9 months. And it was planned within that period as well. So you couldn't do that now. And the fact that he got his railway built within 6 weeks of the first application when he opened the railway in 1883, he only asked the council permission to do it on the 16th of June, and he reopened it. He actually opened it on the 4th of August, so 6 weeks. You can't do that nowadays.
So how important to Brighton is the Volx Railway?
I think it's probably the second most important thing in the town after the Royal Pavilion. The Royal Pavilion is what, and the Prince Regent's involvement in Brighton is what made Brighton a town in the first place. Before that, it was just a fishing village. Along comes the Prince Regent in the 1780s, decides he likes the place, buys a farmhouse, converts it into the Royal Pavilion. Today, the Royal Pavilion is quite undoubtedly the most important tourist attraction in the town. But the Volx Railway is historically as important, because it didn't just show the town that people could move along the beach, it showed nationally that people could move on electric railways, and so it inspired the electrification of the London to Brighton line. As the chairman of the Southern Railway, when the line was finally electrified in 1932, said, "Oh well, Magnus Volk showed us how to do this 49 years ago, and it's taken us all this time to catch up with him."
And that day when we got new trains running out of Brighton, that still running on the same lines.
Yeah, the fact that the London to Brighton line is still one of the busiest lines in the country because it's electric. If it was diesel or, well, steam, it wouldn't be steam now, but if it was diesel, it couldn't run the intense service it does today. And it owes the fact that it's electric to the pioneering work of people like Magnus Volk and Volx Railway in Brighton.
And if Magnus hadn't had this desire, would you think Brighton would have become what it is today?
I think it would have been different, and I don't think it would have been quite the important place it is now. It's the electrification of the railway that made Brighton the premier seaside town in the south from the 1920s onwards.
We hear trains going past us, and
yeah, there's a train
the radio
coming past through.
Yeah. So do you think the railway, as a result of this lottery funding, the future is secure?
I think the railway is absolutely secure now. It's in a better place than it's been for years. We have three of our cars beautifully restored. They will last for another 100 years. I mean, the train we're sitting on is 118 years old. It will last for another 100 years easily now that it's been fully restored. I'd like to think that the railway will still be here in 100 years. Whether it will or not, I can't answer that. I won't be. But it would be nice to think that it will. But certainly for the foreseeable future, the railway is absolutely secure.
Ian Gledhill was telling us all about the forthcoming celebrations for the 135th anniversary of Magnus Volk's railway. Now, having recently spotted a plea for sponsors for the forthcoming Hanover Beer Festival, I recently met up with organiser Jill Peters and brewer Maria Barney, and first asked Jill to tell us when the festival was due to take place.
It's 5th and 6th of October.
And that's at the Hanover Centre?
Yes, in 33 Southover Street in Hanover in Brighton.
Is it open generally to people, or is it just exclusively for Hanover?
No, majority of our people that come along are from Hanover, but some come back year on year from further out. So, yeah, they just come to enjoy it.
Hanover Centre is the community centre for the area, isn't it? And how is that funded?
It's owned by Brighton Council, who are very good landlords of ours. It's just purely funded through hiring out rooms and this one main fundraising event.
But at the moment, you're looking for sponsors for the beer festival.
We've got our main sponsors that come back every year, like Barry Alderton Estate Agents sponsor our glasses along with HR Group. AJ Taylor sponsor our tasting notes, and Q Estate Agents sponsor our tickets and the cider bar. But we look for barrel sponsors. Some local companies come back every year and sponsor a barrel. Sometimes local people come and sponsor a barrel. Perhaps it's their birthday, or it might be a wedding celebration. They might want to recognise their favourite football team. So it's £50 to have your name on a barrel, and you get quite a bit of promotion for that, plus discounted tickets.
And discounted beer?
No, not discounted beer, no. Beer, it's very good. It's £3.50 a pint once you're in. So there is a bargain, it's particularly in Brighton, yeah.
Back to more about the festival in a moment, but let's talk to Maria about beer. And you've got your own brewery.
It's not my brewery, but I work for Good Things Brewing Co, who are based out in Eridge, which is near Tunbridge Wells, so just about in Sussex still. And we are currently building a new brewery, which will be one of the most environmentally friendly in the world when it's finished, which is very exciting.
Brighton used to be home to a lot of brewers. I'm afraid I'm of the generation, and a lot of our listeners, that can remember the awful thing called Watley's Red Barrel. So what is special about real beer?
Well, I'm not old enough to remember Watley's Red Barrel, but I've heard the horror stories. And the thing that's really special about the beers that we sell at Hanover is that the way that they're made, and a lot of them are from very small breweries, small businesses. We try to use independent businesses where we can. None of them would exist if it wasn't for camera and championing of small breweries and real ale. So we do have, the majority of the beer that we sell is real ale from a cask. But last year for the 30th anniversary, we introduced 4 keg beers, which, when we're thinking about Watney's, it sounds a bit evil. But again, we're using small breweries, independent breweries, making really lovely beer that just so happens to be in a keg. So we'll probably have 4 or 5 of those again this year, but we're looking at 35 different choices of real ale.
That's mind-boggling. But what's the difference between real ale and the ale that you get in some of the big chain pubs?
I mean, broadly, the ale that you'll get in big chain pubs is often cask ale, but broadly the difference between cask and keg is the carbonation and the temperature at which it's served. So cask ale will be served at a slightly higher temperature, but still between 10 and 12 degrees, so nice and cool to your lips. It has slightly less carbonation, so less fizzy. Which, if you're going to have a session at a beer festival, means you can drink slightly more.
You mentioned drinking. I mean, a beer festival is not just about drinking as much as you can in a short period of time.
Oh, no, absolutely not. So at Hanover, we definitely encourage people to drink responsibly. We have presents from St John's Ambulance here, just in case anybody takes it a bit too far. But what the festival is really about is people enjoying beers, enjoying talking to people in the community. We do have people come back every year that will pick up a programme and write notes, rate the beers out of 10, which for me, because I'm very into beer, is always a delight to see. And then we do have big groups of people that come along in fancy dress and play games all evening, which is also delightful. It's just all about people having a nice time and trying some nice beer along the way.
And you mentioned an enormous quantity of beer. What's the difference between them?
So, well, every year, so I've been involved with getting the beer sorted since 2013. And Ali Charlesworth from Brighton Beer, he joined me a few years ago to give me a helping hand. And what we do is we split them into categories. So we'll have some milds, we'll have some bests, we'll have some bitters, we'll have some pale ales, some IPAs. Every year we try and get some speciality beers. So last year we had a jasmine pale ale from Thornbridge that was really lovely. We'll try and get a wheat beer, maybe try and get a pilsner in cask. We just try and find a big range of beers. But every year there's a list of tasting notes that Ali and I work quite hard on. We'll always try and put a couple of little jokes in there. And so there's something for everyone. And hopefully there'll be something new for people to try too that they haven't tried before.
So you don't have to be a sandal-wearing, bearded a person that I mean, that's the image in some people's mind, isn't it?
It is. That is the stereotype, I suppose. But not at all. We found that I see every year there's a huge cross-section of people that come along to the festival, and they're just here to have a nice time and try something new. And I think beer in the last kind of 5-10 years has become has a much wider audience now. Slightly younger audience too, is quite nice to see. So yeah, I don't think that there's any specific type of person that drinks beer at all.
Now, you talked about Camera, the campaign for real ale. Do you think without their efforts back 20, 30 years ago before you were born, without them there wouldn't be real ale?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very clear-cut part of brewing history, as well as they raise a lot of awareness to the general public of what was good to drink, and the campaigns they do now for campaigning for pubs and small businesses and tax relief are really valuable. I am a member of CAMRA. I have had a checkered relationship with the organisation in the past, mostly because of some of the members. But as a whole, I think they do really good work.
Back to Jill and the event itself.
Yeah.
You were talking about sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
What's the level of sponsorship that you're looking for a barrel?
It's £50 for a barrel. So you get your name on the barrel. So you see it on the night and get your photo taken with your barrel. It's in the tasting notes. It's on our publicity, which is Facebook, and our website with links to your business. And as I say, you can come along to the VIP launch party, which is before the main event on the Friday night.
We talked earlier about who the event is for, but how can people find out more if they're listening to this and they think, oh, I'd like to come along to that, or I might like to sponsor? How can they get in touch with you?
They can contact me, Jill Peters, on our Beer Festival email address, which is beerfestival@hanovercommunity.org.uk. They can leave a message on our Facebook page, which is Hanover Beer Fest, or they can ring the Hanover Community Centre office and they can get that number from our website and leave a message for me.
It sounds like a very serious event with serious businesses. But is it a fun event?
Oh, it's a real fun event. There's nothing serious about it at all. No, no. People just come along to have a good time, but it's a controlled good time. We don't have trouble here at all, no.
And how important is that to you as an organiser?
What, that it's a fun event? It just makes it easier because we have an awful lot of volunteers, particularly on the two nights, putting in many hours. And so we like to know that everyone's had a good time.
I'm sure we'll be finding out more of it about the event itself nearer the time.
Mm.
If somebody wants to sponsor a barrel, are the contact details the same as the ones you just given?
Yes, exactly. They can contact me through the beer. I check the Beer Festival email address and the Facebook, so that's how they contact me.
Jill Peters and Mari Barney there talking about the Hanover Beer Festival. Now let me repeat those all-important contact details. For tickets to Me and My Girl at Chichester Festival Theatre, go to www.cft.org.uk/whatson, again all one word, or phone 01243 781 312. For information on Rotting Dean Fair, it's www.rottingdeanvillage.org.uk/events. And for details of Wooding Dean Neighbourhood Watch, or indeed any Neighbourhood Watch schemes in Sussex, it's www.sussexnwfed.org.uk. And finally, the Hanover Beer Festival. It's www.hanovercommunity.org.uk/hanover-beer-festival. So this is Chris English signing off by thanking you for listening to this edition of At Home This Morning. And also to thank my executive producer, Richard Davis, for all the technical operation matters. And finally to thank you for letting me join you via your radio. And so, until we meet again over the airwaves, keep safe and bye for now.